kind of morning that don't fade away. Like it, yeah, let it play, share it, yeah, pass it on your way, suburb, don't hesitate, David L. Gray in the morning, don't delay.
It is David L. Gray in the morning. Glad to have you here for this special show. It is, you know, we live stream every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. But I had something hot that I needed to get to you today. And tomorrow we're going to have a guest. We're going to have William Priest on, talking about his conversion story from Protestant to a rad trad and then to just a regular, normal, sacrament-loving, Christ-loving Catholic. So he'll be on tomorrow. And so I wanted to come in today to clear the air and try to remove all the lies that we've been told about the U.S.-Iran conflict, dispute about the just war, whether it's just or not just. I want to talk about what J.D. Vance said at a Turning Point USA conference and how the bishops pushed back against him after they heard what he said. So a lot of people are lying. A lot of people are just not being honest with us. I mean, because of that, a lot of people are suffering. People are dying because of this silly, demonic, diabolical game that's being played all around the world right now. So I'm going to drop a lot of truth bombs today. Some of them that you may not want to hear, but I think it's necessary for us to hear and just be honest about what's really going on, that we're all being played. And that's today's show. Well, I have a reflection on today's readings. It's pretty similar to what we talked about yesterday. We're still in John 3 in the gospel in the same Old Testament first reading as well, same psalm as well. So not a whole lot of new things to offer there. But I'll be back tomorrow with another reflection on the readings at Mass. But we are going to get into the saint of the day. It's one of my favorite saints, Saint Bernadette of Lourdes. So let's get into that. This is David L. Gray in the morning. And today's saint of the day is being sponsored by Saint Dominic's Media, your source for everything Catholic liturgy, Catholic history, what the church teaches about against Freemasonry. We have free courses on that, a masterclass on the Catholic prohibition against Freemasonry. We have retreats, online courses, books, podcasts, everything. So make sure you hop over to St. Dominic's Medium, visit our sponsor, and also sign up for the mailing list. You sign up today, you'll get a audio version of the readings at Mass for this Sunday from my book, The Catholic Catechism on Freemasonry. So make sure you sign up for this mailing list, and so you can get that. So I love St. Bernadette. One of my best parts, my favorite memories I think I'll have from living over here in Europe was that my opportunity to go to Lourdes and to spend, I think, maybe 4 days there and to go into the grotto a few times. Ever since then, I have a devotion to her. And so St. Bernadette of Sorbios was born in 1884 in a small Prinian town in Lourdes. And what is still modern-day southwestern France, a place that would become one of the most visited pilgrimage sites in the world because of her fidelity and her simplicity. St. Bernadette was a poor miller's daughter, frail in health, yet unwavering in spirit. When the Blessed Mother Mary, the Virgin Mary, appeared to her 18 times in 1858 at the Grotto Amasabelli, through Bernadette, Our Lady called the world to penance, prayer, and trust in God, and really a miraculous spring that sprung up and whose water continues to bring healing to countless pilgrims. In fact, I still have some water from Lourdes down in our basement, our attached apartment. And Bernadette later entered the Sisters of Charity of Nevers, embracing a hidden life of humility, obedience, and suffering offered to Christ. She's honored today as a patron saint of the sick, the poor, the shepherds, and of the Lord's itself, where millions of sick, healing, and conversion happens every year. Pope Pius XI canonized her in 1933, recognizing her purity of heart and steadfast witness to the truth and her apparitions. In sacred art, as you see on the screen that I have here, this image I generated, Saint Bernadette is traditionally depicted as a young peasant girl in simple clothing, brown or gray shawl, blue dress, white headscarf, a rosary in hand. She is often shown kneeling before the grotto, illuminated by the presence of the Immaculate Conception, the apparition, with a candle, the rocky grotto, and a spring serving as enduring symbols of her encountering grace. So, Saint Bernadette of Lourdes, pray for us. This is David L. Gray in the morning. I will be right back with the story we got to get into. Hey there, I am David L. Gray. I am a Catholic theologian getting my doctoral degree in liturgical catechesis from the Catholic University of America. And this is my morning show. Welcome in. We do this every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Start off with Joy in the Morning, where I give you the saint of the day and an enlightening commentary on the readings of Mass. And then we get into something interesting. I'm looking at something in faith or culture from a lens of a Catholic who believes in faith, reason, logic, and the teachings of the church. There's no deviation from the magisterium here. Why people like this channel, why people sub, why people keep coming back is because I look at things from a very critical lens. This is no emotions applied, no groupthink, no talking points to the day, none of that. Nothing campy. I'm not saying what I'm supposed to say. I'm saying what's true. Sometimes we get in those boxes, and I think that's very dangerous when we get comfortable and we just go along with what people think and what we're supposed to believe. No, you know, if it's not dogmatic truth, then we ask the questions, why? And so that's what we're doing here. And I hope that you like it. Yeah, I may get emotional myself. I may call something stupid or retarded. I may crack some jokes. But that's, again, that's why people like this channel. That's why they sub. That's why they share. That's why they like. That's why they join a community. And I hope that you do too. Let's get back to the show. So let's start with Vice President J.D. Vance in this talk at Turning Point USA conference this week. And I didn't want to talk about this on Wednesday because, you know, the dust hadn't yet settled. Sometimes you just have to let things sit there for a minute, let them cook for a while. And that's happened. So he said what he had to say, and then the bishops responded. So we're going to get into both of those things, and I'm going to tell you what all this is actually all about. So let's review what J.D. Vance said, and then what the bishops pushed back with, and then I'm going to drop something on you that you may not be ready to hear, but I'm going to tell you anyway. So let's get into clips number 1, 2, and 3. I'm going to tell you what I did like and what I did not like about what J.D. Vance had to say. And here's stock number 1.
I've seen that the Vatican and the Pope and the President have been in the news lately. So as a Catholic, what does it feel like to be, you know, in the middle of that? Here's the thing about this. So first of all, you will sometimes hear people say, well, you know, the Vatican, the church, whether it's the Protestant church, the Catholic church, like, you know, they should preach the gospel. They should ignore public policy. I actually don't agree with that. I actually think that it's a good thing when Christian leaders, whether they're Catholic or Protestant, part of preaching the gospel is talking about how the gospel applies to the issues of the day. So I've never been one of these people who say that you should never have, you know, Christian leadership not talking about politics, or frankly, political leaders not talking about their Christian faith.
Yeah, that clip I didn't terribly not mind. That was just the intro to his talk. What I did not like in that part right there, and I thought really set the tone for a lot of what he's going to say thereafter, was this false equivalency. Now, he says he doesn't mind when Catholic leaders talk, or when the Pope speaks, and when Protestants speak as well. I really didn't care for that, because it created, this is indifferentism. I think it's fundamentally different, theologically different, metaphysically different, when a church speaks on morality, when a pope speaks on morality. I mean, if you're going to throw Protestants in, you might as well throw in, I don't know, name the cult. It could be Jehovah's Witnesses. It could be Mormons. It could be Buddhists. It could be, I don't know, Heaven's Gate. It just, if you're going to throw people in, just throw them all in as if everyone can speak authoritatively about the moral law and the eternal law and the natural law and how it applies and intersects and how public policy should be formed based upon those things. No, on the contrary, I think it's distinctly different when a church speaks, because that is the authority that Christ gave the church. And the seat that the Pope sits in is the seat that Christ gave his vicar to sit in, and the authority to teach in his name. So that's, no one has that to offer. No one comes to speak in the name of Christ. No one can interpret the scriptures or authoritatively as the church can. So I didn't like how J.D. Vance created this false equivalency and really promoted indifferentism. Protestants do not have the same things to say and with the same weight and with the same authority as Christ and his church. So that was that. Let me get to stock number two.
It was to preach the gospel, okay? And again, I think that sometimes in the context, like, it doesn't bother me, even when I disagree with him. And I have a lot of respect for the Pope. I like him. I admire him. I've gotten to know him a little bit. It doesn't bother me when he speaks on issues of the day, frankly, even when I disagree with how he's applying a particular principle. So the most obvious example is, it has frustrated me that some of the Catholic clergy have attacked mercilessly the Trump administration on immigration. It is a constant idea that somehow everything that the Trump administration does when it comes to securing our borders is inhumane. And my constant response to that is, how is it humane to allow drug traffickers and sex traffickers to bring little kids across the southern border?
Amen.
How is that humane? But again, I'd almost rather have the conversation. So I kind of like, even when there's disagreement, I like it when the Pope comments on questions of immigration. I like it when the Pope talks about abortion. I like it when the Pope talks about matters of war and peace, because I think that at the very least, it invites a conversation. So I think some people, you know, their reaction to this is to say, well, you know, he shouldn't have said that. And look, there are certainly things that the Pope has said in the last few months that I disagree with.
And I like also what J.D. Vance has to say here in some places, and I think is a whole lot more eloquent, obviously, than what President Trump had to say about the Pope and what the Pope has to say. I like that some of the distinctions that J.D. Vance here outlined, and some of the concerns I think a politician will have. So I think he really gave a really good example about how the church, oftentimes in public policymakers, speak past one another, right? So the church will have some legitimate concerns about how people are treated. And a state will have some legitimate concerns about protecting their borders, right? And I don't think the church does enough job affirming what the state believes. That's just, I would say, I would argue, is part of just natural law, that a country has a right to its borders. It's like hell has borders and heaven has borders, and that people should respect the law. Okay. That's what the church has always taught. But for some reason, in this dialogue between the church and the state, they aren't really hearing one another. They're just talking past one another. So I like what J.D. Vance had to say about some of these disputes open up the door to conversation. So the church has to do a much better job here. And I think the onus is on the church to do a better job than on policymakers to do a better job, because, again, the church has the authority in moral matters, and it should weigh in. All policy touches on morality. Because as Catholics, we believe that there's five different types of laws. There's the eternal law. There's the natural law. there's the positive law, which, you know, I'm sorry, there's an eternal law, there's a moral law, natural law. Then there's positive law, a law that comes from policies, and then there's canon law. But all of them draw from the same source, which is the eternal law, of which the church is the authentic interpreter of. That has been revealed by God. So it's good for the church, and the church should be welcome into the policy room, and the church has to stop talking past people and speaking with them about these things. I didn't like how J.D. Vance said, well, the Pope's job is to speak the gospel. You know, according to scripture and what Catholics believe, the Pope has more than just, Pope just doesn't have one job. His job, he has three jobs. It's one, to proclaim the gospel. That's what J.D. Vance said, proclaim the gospel. He also has two other jobs, one, to be a source of unity for his brother bishops, and a third one is to be shepherd, okay? And so we get these three duties from the Pope. They come from scripture, they come from Jesus Christ, because two of the duties of the Pope comes from confessions that Jesus made about Peter, and then there's one confession that Peter made about himself, okay? Peter, the Pope, first Pope. So Peter says that Jesus asked him, who do you say that I am? And Peter says, you are the Messiah and Son of the Living God, right? So, and so out of that confession, every time we make a confession, there comes a responsibility. You confess something, you have responsibility to live out that confession. So if you say, oh, I love you, to your spouse, well, you have a duty to live out that confession of love. That's natural. So out of that confession, Jesus gives him a job. Oh, you have the keys. You know, okay. So, and this had not been revealed to you from man, but from God. And so this is his first duty, to proclaim who Jesus is. The second duty is also comes for another confession, when Peter denies that he knows Jesus Christ. And then he turns back, and he wants to turn back. And Jesus says, Jesus says, I'm going to pray for you that you strengthen your brothers, that you are going to deny me, but I'm going to pray for you that you will strengthen your brothers. Okay. So this confession that Jesus made about Peter comes with a responsibility, that Peter is supposed to be the source of unity for his brother bishops, because Jesus prayed that he would go back and strengthen his brothers. So the Pope is a source of strength for his brother bishops. Now, a third confession is the one that Peter made. And Jesus asked him three times, do you love me? And the Greek is, do you agape? Do you eros me? No, it's the eros. Do you agape me? And Peter responds back saying, well, I phileo you. So he says, Jesus asked, do you love me in a divine way, three times? And Peter responds three times, well, I love you in a brotherly way. But with each of these confessions comes a responsibility. Jesus says, "Well, feed my sheep, pasture my sheep, tend to my sheep." So Peter has a duty. Successor Peter has a duty to be proclaimer, unifier, and shepherd. Okay. So J.D. Vance is a convert, and he should know these things. So when we reduce the Pope just to being someone who said, oh, the Pope is just supposed to preach the gospel, it diminishes his entire role that he was given from Jesus himself, to be proclaimer, shepherd, and unifier. Okay. And that's essential when it comes to policymaking, because the Pope has a role here, not just to proclaim the gospel, but he's doing that as shepherd, right? So when he's teaching from his office, he's doing so in a way that I'm caring for my sheep. Okay, that's why I'm saying these things. Okay, so as Christ has sheep in Iran, he has sheep in Israel, he has sheep in the United States. The Pope, when he's coming into public policy, he's speaking on behalf of those who he's been given to take care of. So J.D. Vance, is important for him to know that as well. But so, and then at the end of the clip, he talks about what he likes, what the Pope does. He says, I like when the Pope speaks about abortion. I like when the Pope speaks about this. So I like that J.D. Vance, President J.D. Vance, says that there's room in here for us to, there's room in public policy for the Pope. I like that. And again, there should be, because again, we believe in five, that the eternal law, moral law, natural law, moral law, positive law, and canon law. should be something that we draw from. We just happen to live in a time where we're making things up that are not connected to the eternal law, natural law, moral law, positive law anymore. We're making up positive laws that are disconnected from the eternal law and the natural law and the moral law. Things such as, you know, two people of the same gender can get married. You can just kill yourself through euthanasia. We can kill children through child sacrifice. All these things are disconnected from the eternal law and even the natural law. So it's good that J.D. Vance wants the Pope there. All right. So that's a good invitation. Now, let me play stock number three, and then we'll be done with J.D. Vance, and then we'll get on to what the U.S. United States of Catholic Bishops responded to him saying.
Number one, when the Pope says that God is never on the side of those who wield the sword, there is more than a thousand year tradition of just war theory. Okay. Now we can of course have disagreements about whether this or that conflict is just, but I think that it's important in the same way that it's important for the Vice President of the United States to be careful when I talk about matters of public policy. I think it's very, very important for the Pope to be careful when he talks about matters of theology.
Yeah, and here's a clip that, just taken out of context from everything else that J.D. Vance said, you know, sounds really bad. And this is the first one I saw, too, and, you know, I blew a gasket. I thought, like, how dare J.D. Vance, who's, you know, just a redneck with a degree from Harvard or Yale, good universities, dare lecture the Pope, you know, who's, you know, the Pope, and he has advanced degrees in theology. Canon law and things like that. It came off sounding really bad. And I was like, J.D. Vance had 24 hours to come up with something coherent, more coherent than what President Trump has said. But then he offers a statement which is even less coherent than what President Trump was saying. But there's some things here we could take a look at. Number one, I think there was a lot of ignorance about what the Pope was saying. He was quoting Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, when he says that God doesn't hear the prayers of warmongers. And the thing that a lot of people miss that I covered in an essay that I wrote over at the Catholic Stand was that this has a lot of space in history. This saying here from this quote here from Isaiah. Isaiah 1:15. So we see so many people saying it in the tradition of the church. We see Origen, St. Clement, Alexander, St. Cyprian of Carthage, St. John Chrysostom, St. Thomas Aquinas, St. John Paul II. They, as I write in this essay, they all use a verse to teach that God not listening signifies a refusal of complicity with bloodshed. Okay. So, and I say, in that sense, there's nothing new in what Pope Leo taught about the incompatibility of prayer with bloodshed and when war is justified by religious rhetoric. Then I say, what is new or distinctive in Pope Leo's Palm Sunday homily was not the underlying logic. Isaiah's warning that God does not accept religious devotion when violence and injustice remain unrepentant is a constant across the fathers of modern papal teaching, but rather the rhetorical packaging he chose, saying Jesus, King of Peace, who rejects war. Okay. So that verse has been used many times throughout the last 2,000 years to affirm that God does not hear the prayers of those who wage war and those who say that they're doing it for God's sake and all the religious rhetoric that's attached to it. But rather, the only thing that Pope Leo added was the gloss that Jesus Christ, the King of Peace, is the one who rejects war. So that was a new insertion, but it's consistent with what the tradition and the popes have always taught. I didn't like how he's equated the Pope's position to his either. You know, he says, well, I'm a policymaker. That's my job. The Pope also has a job And so I have to be careful when I'm talking about policy. The Pope has to be careful when he's speaking about theology. Again, that's a false equivalency. It's not even close. And maybe he's not trying to make that equivalency. You know, he and the Pope have a similar job. But, you know, when the Pope is teaching in his office as Pope, and he's teaching magisterially, I'm not saying infallibly or anything like that. Just when he's speaking as Pope, he is in the office of teacher. Okay. When J.D. Vance is doing policy, okay, that doesn't carry the same weight. Because whatever J.D. Vance says about policy is an opinion. It may become a law, but that law can change. Okay. There's a difference, I think. So there's some differences here when the Pope is teaching magisterially in his office as the teacher of the church. So I didn't really care for that false equivalency. And I'm sure if J.D. Vance had a time to think about these things, he would probably take that back. And I think what goes along with, I think, this critique, I think there's an underlying suspicion of the Pope. And let's talk about that for a moment. It's really act. Okay, is that fair or not? Because I think a lot of people make a fair point when they look at the history of Robert Prevost, you know, before he was Pope, when he was priest, even before he was cardinal. And they see a lot on his old Twitter account. They see a lot of Trump derangement syndrome, a lot of evidence that he had Trump derangement syndrome, and that some of his tweets just reflect a person who's just a leftist maniac. Just this leftist maniac Trump derangement syndrome tweets. Anyone just objectively will probably qualify these and say, okay, this priest is just far left and he has Trump derangement syndrome. So I think it's fair. Yeah, so I think it would be fair for people to ask, like, well, hey, has that bias actually left the Pope, or is he still the same biased person that he was? I think that's a fair ask. Let me fix my camera here real quick. All right. And so, because I mean, the idea is that, oh, well, he became Pope and now what his entire bias is supposed to have been erased now. All those Trump derangement tweets and all that leftist maniac stuff, has that somehow erased, magically erased in some sort of metaphysical way since he's became Pope? Or does he still have Trump derangement syndrome? I think that's a fair question. And really the only way so that is a fair thing to ask. And I think the only way to overcome it is for the Pope to not appear to be a tool of the liberals. You know, in having your press, the Vatican press, disclose that you met with someone like David Axelrod. Like, the Pope meets with a bunch of people privately. Why is it being disclosed publicly that you met with David Axelrod, who's like a DNC operative who still works closely with Obama? So when people wonder if the Pope is now saying all these things to help the Democrats get elected in 2026 and 2028, I mean, that's a fair question. You take his tweets, you take who he's meeting with. It's fair to ask, okay? Now, even though it's fair to ask, the question is not the answer. Like, we just can't just leap to some sort of non sequitur and just leap to a therefore. And so we can ask the question, but it's not also fair. It's not to jump to conclusions or create suspicions. You know, questions are not proof and suspicions are not proof. but it's fair to ask, because I think the record is out there and some things that happened recently just out there. And I think the Pope should respect that and think he should. If he doesn't want people to think he's some sort of biased leftist tool of the Democrats and a socialist and a communist, well, maybe he should not disclose certain things publicly, like he met with David Axelrod. I think that would go a long way. And maybe the Pope doesn't care that he has that record as a leftist and that people identify him as such. Even President Trump says such. Say, oh, I like his brother better. He's a MAGA guy. But Trump, the Pope is, a radical liberal, Maybe he doesn't care, but I think it would be incumbent upon a Pope, if he wants to enter fairly into conversations and keep that door open for dialogue, and to not have people think that they're talking past them, to present himself as someone who is not biased. That's what I would say. So, but overall, I would say one thing I didn't like about J.D. Vance's take in some of his comments was that he did not really demonstrate that he's not a tool for Israel and BlackRock. And I'll talk more about that shortly. But first, let's take a look at the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. Let's take a look at their pushback and see what they said about J.D. Vance's comments. So this was their response to J.D. Vance. They said, in light of recent public comments regarding the Catholic Church teaching on just war and peace, on war and peace, Bishop James Mossa, chairman of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Doctrine, issued the following statement saying, quote, for 1,000 years, the Catholic Church has taught just war theory as it is that long tradition the Holy Father carefully references in his comments on war. A constant tenet of that just war tradition is a nation can only legitimately take up a sword in self-defense. Once all peace efforts have failed, he cites Catechism paragraph. That is, to be a just war, it must be a defense against another who actively wages war, which is what the Holy Father actually said. He does not listen to the prayers of those who wage war. Again, quoting Isaiah 1. So when Pope Leo XIV speaks as Supreme Pastor of Universal Church, he's not merely offering opinions on theology. He is preaching the gospel and exercising ministry as the vicar of Christ. This consistent teaching of the church is insisting that all people of goodwill must pray and work towards lasting peace while avoiding evils and injustices that accompany all wars. So the Catholic bishops just pushed back with just trying to recatechize J.D. Vance. And because he is a Catholic, he is a convert, and they're just reaching out to recatechize him about what does the church actually teach about just war. And again, that goes back to the essay I wrote over at Catholic Stand, which you can check out. I'll drop in the comments here. That the place that where Pope Leo is really moving to on a just war is really it's really nothing new, although I suspect in the coming months or years, he may insert into the just war doctrine a phrase that we now find in the church's teaching on state-sanctioned homicide, death penalty, that he may say that it is contrary to the gospel, just to reemphasize, because we say that about the death penalty now, that it's contrary to the gospel, which is we really elevate something to being like the infallible teaching of the church, and saying something is just, if it's contrary to the gospel, it means it's contrary to Christ. And this is what the church is teaching out of Veritatis Splendor, the church's understanding of moral theology now, that Christ is the moral center of what we believe. And so rather than moral theology being something what the scholastics taught, that it was something just you know, something more philosophical, something that can really be negotiated with. The church now, through Veritas et Splendor, is saying that no, our understanding of what is good or bad comes from Jesus Christ himself, and that the ends do not justify the means no matter what. So I wouldn't be surprised, and I articulate that in an essay, that if Pope Leo were to insert into the just war doctrine that it's illegitimate war is contrary to the gospel. And so I think what he wants to do is really make just the just war, just really explain how narrow and how rare a just war is. And I think he wants to emphasize the fact that our efforts for peace have to begin long before, you know, it gets to the point of war, and that we just can't give up on peace, because peace isn't like an object. Peace is a person, and his name is Jesus Christ. So we don't give up on peace. So I think that's the way he wants to head there. But I think this really segues into also a frequent comment that I keep reading on my Facebook page. Especially in the last couple of days, people are constantly making just weird distinctions. One of the weird distinctions, I mean, distinctions that the Catholic Church doesn't make. And one of them that I keep seeing on my Facebook page is that there's some sort of dip that I keep seeing people saying, oh, well, the Pope is teaching pacifism. Pacifism. I never heard that word so much than in the last few weeks. I want to respond to that real quick here. I want to say we have to understand what pacifism actually is, and rather than just throwing that word around and trying to put that on a Pope and saying, oh, he's being a pacifist. I just don't think people understand what pacifism is. Pacifism rejects all violence, and calls it immoral. So if you're a pacifist, you cannot even defend yourself against violence. Pacifism does not recognize self-defense. So I think once you know that definition, you will see, well, how that's contrary with the just war, and how it's in conflict with just Catholic moral theology. We have a right to defend ourselves because we're the Imago Dei. And so if someone dies because I'm defending myself, doesn't mean my intent was to kill them. My intent was to preserve my own life, which I have a duty to do. So the just war theory, it assumes that violence is sometimes morally permissible, but only under extremely narrow, rigorous conditions. And this is what Pope Leo is simply trying to reinforce. Whereas in the past, the idea of just war, especially during the Crusades, the idea of the narrow scope of just war may have been this big. Pope Leo is like, here, you can barely see through the hole where Pope Leo is saying that a war can be just. And we'll get into why, because we're long past World War I and World War II. War nowadays is a very different concept that we have to explore. And I'll get to that shortly and talk about what this is actually all about and the diabolical ideas that are surrounding this whole idea. But so there's a strict application now of the just war theory that does not move you towards pacifism, even though it's very strict, it's very narrow. The possibility of a war being just and legitimate nowadays, it still doesn't move us to pacifism, because self-defense is still possible. Rather, it simply exposes how really rare a real war meets that moral criteria. So that's a short form. So in long form, I would say pacifism teaches that all violence is always immoral. But that is not what the stringent teaching of just war claims. Pacifism rejects every use of force, even defense of the innocent. Whereas just war begins with the opposite premise, that force can be legitimate, but only under extremely narrow, focused, objective, and verifiable circumstances. And so going into that, so even when Jesus teaches things like, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed are the meek, that's not political pacifism. But what Jesus is pointing to really just a transformation of the heart so that we don't even get to this point. It's a heart that rejects vengeance, a heart that you know, because the vengeance, the heart of vengeance, as Jesus talks about in the Sermon on the Mount, loves violence. Can't wait for it to get back. All right. So while still allowing legitimate authority to protect the innocent. So when just war criteria are applied honestly, just war, right intention, last resort, proportionality, non-combatant immunity, right, don't kill kids. They reveal a simple and a rarely modern conflicts really meet that moral bar. And so that rigor doesn't make someone a pacifist when they're saying that war has to be, you have to have the right intention. It has to be the last resort. Like peace is completely, completely, completely off the table. That it has to be proportional. Like it has to target the problem. People who are not combatants can't be killed. They're immune from the violence. Modern war, it's just hard to get there with modern war in these bombs, in these drones, and the complications also that I'll get into here shortly. So when a church applies this rigor, the church doesn't become pacifist. Again, it just exposes how often the state fails the church's standards to use ethical use of force. And so again, Jesus teaching, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed are the merciful, blessed are the meek. When he tells Jesus to put away his sword, when Peter is about to pull out a sword and cut off somebody's ear or neck. When Jesus rises from the dead, when they give him a death penalty and he rises from the dead and does not come for vengeance, but rather comes for healing. That's not pacifism either. Rather, I would say that's proactive love. That's love being proactive, not pacifism. And there's a difference. So the same spirit that moved Jesus to forgive, to restore, to reconcile, that same spirit is given to us in baptism. And I would say if we love as Christ loved, if we reach out to people, we truly reach the people as he reached and we touch as he touched, then war, which is really only a symptom of sin. Let's be honest about that. War is a symptom of sin. I think it becomes less likely to arise if we do our job as Christians to reach, touch, and heal. But the problem is that we don't believe in being proactive, do we? We don't. It's crazy. We don't believe in being proactively the hands, feet, and heart of God. But when we fail to love proactively, when we fail to do that, and then sin happens, and then war happens, we say, oh, we have to go to war. It's really not being, you know, taking accountability and being responsible. And like in real life, like if one of your kids came to you and they have some consequences of not being good persons, you might have them deal with those consequences. You just might. You may not step in and fix the situation for them. In the same way, if we just fail to love, and we get to the point where we have to do some self-defense, fine. But at the same time, we have to have some sort of, we have to look in the mirror and say that we failed to do something. There's something that we did or something that we failed to do along the way that got us to this point. And although we're going to take this action to defend ourselves this time, we just have to do better next time. The problem with a lot of countries, especially the United States, is that we just haven't learned that lesson. Our foreign policy still sucks. Our foreign policy still makes poor countries poor. We still go into other countries and we take all their resources, drive them into poverty. And then when those people run for the border to come into this country, you know, we're like, oh, crap, we got to keep them out. Fine. But we have to acknowledge that and maybe do something better than a country, build some schools, provide safe environments, do something so that situation doesn't happen. Or our foreign policy sucks so bad that we assassinate leaders, we arm conflicts, we create revolutions, we do all this crappy stuff all around the world. Then a war breaks out and we're like, oh crap, we have to do something about this. Fine. But you have to look in the mirror and say, okay, what can we do better with our foreign policy, though, so that we don't create some crap that we then have to go step in and clean up, right? So you just have to take responsibility. And again, we just don't, but we don't want to do that hard work. We don't want to love, especially when it comes to loving strangers. So we always default to force because we have not yet trusted the power of charity to prevent conflicts that we didn't have to later justify. Now, here is the show. So I said all that, but I've been here for 46 minutes. Okay, I've said all that, my friends, to say what I'm about to say. And this is the thing that I don't think a lot of people want to hear. But I'm going to be straight up honest with you about this. This is just some just straight up adult talk right here. There's a something else that I keep reading on my Facebook page. And it goes like this. People say that we can't let Iran get a nuclear weapon because they will use it against Israel. That's the saying. We can't let Iran get a nuclear weapon because they would use it against Israel. It's all over my Facebook page when people respond. It's all over the news. It's just the thing that people says. They say. It's the talking points. It's the mantra. It's the groupthink. It's the go-to line to bring into the conversation to justify doing what we feel we have to do. Because we can't let Iran get a nuclear weapon because they'll use it against Israel. So this is what everyone is saying. This is what I'm hearing every person who wants to justify this war say. But the problem is that no one is ever asking. We never ask the question whether that's true or not. Is that true? If Iran gets a nuclear weapon, they'll use it against Israel. We have to ask if that question is true because hundreds of people are dying, soldiers are dying, lives are being destroyed. Millions of dollars of our tax dollars are being spent because of this story. We can't let Iran get a nuclear weapon because they'll use it against Israel. Is that true? But we don't ask that. It's crazy that we don't. Nor do we ask, where did that idea come from? Or who said that? You know, who's a silly question? You know, I talk about that on the show all the time. But, I mean, there's the other question. Why? So we don't ask, is it true? Who said that? Why did they say it? Why are they telling it to us? If you don't even have to be my age to know that just hearing something like that, Iran cannot get a nuclear weapon because they'll use it against Israel. Just hearing that, you should be able to hear that, and then you should be able to take it and place it in a category called fear-based mongering. This is a fear-based narrative. It could be true. But this is a fear-based narrative. It's supposed to make us afraid. It's a fear-based narrative used in the United States. It's a U.S.-based foreign policy rhetorical tool. Anytime you hear a politician say something that is intended to make you afraid, your first reaction should be to ask whether that's true. I don't care what it is. It could be this narrative: Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon because they'll use it against Israel. I don't care if it's that narrative that's supposed to make us afraid, or, oh, if you elect the Republicans, they're going to take away your Social Security. Oh, if you elect the Democrats, you're going to lose this. Or if you elect the Republicans, you're going to lose your right to choose something. Those are fear-based narratives. They could be true, but you have to ask the question, is that true? Because if it's a politician that told you that, you have to ask the question. Because a politician's job is to only get the reelected. People say, oh, politicians, their job is to help us. No, the job of a politician is to get reelected and to enrich themselves while they're in the office. They're not here for you. They're here for themselves. Okay? So who's telling that story? And why? Is because they're telling us that fear-based narrative only to make you afraid. That's why they use fear-based narratives, so that once you're afraid, it will then force you to give someone else your agency to protect you from that thing they told you to be afraid of. That's why they tell you these fear-based narratives. Oh, you should be afraid of this. Because once they make you afraid of it, then you vote for them. You give them your agency. Oh, please protect me. You told me I should be scared of this. Well, protect me. It's the one of the most powerful tools of transferring power from one person to another there is. Fear-based narratives. We talk a lot about the transfer of wealth. Let's talk about the transfer of fear. All right. Now I have some questions for you. So what if I told you that the fear-based narrative that Iran cannot get a nuclear weapon because they'll use it against Israel? What if I told you that that fear-based narrative did not originate from U.S. intelligence assessments? That did not come from any intelligence source ever anywhere. There's never been some sort of intelligence source that said, because we don't have a crystal ball. We don't have time machines. So it's always been impossible for any intelligence source to say, oh, if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, they'll use it against Israel. No, Iran never said that. No one has ever said that. So intelligent groups have never been able to. That didn't come from them. So if it didn't come from U.S. intelligence or U.K. intelligence or anyone's intelligence source, where did it come from? It came from political speeches. It came from lobbying groups. It came from regional rivals. It came from think tank messaging. It came from media repetition. But you know who it especially came from? It came from AIPAC. That's where we get it from. The American Israel Public Affairs Committee. They are the first people who started telling us decades ago that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, I think they said about Iraq too, right? That's why Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Right? So they've been saying that if certain groups, certain countries get nuclear weapons, they'll use them against us. The Jews. This came from the Jews. And I hate to sound like E. Michael Jones right now, but I have the receipts. I'm just going to demonstrate it to you. But what if I did tell you that, right? That this whole narrative that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon because they use it against Jews, that came from AIPAC. And AIPAC has been one of the most prominent U.S. advocacy organizations pushing that message that Iran's nuclear program represents an existential threat to Israel. And mind you, every representative in Congress, senator and congressperson, has an AIPAC lobbyist assigned to them. AIPAC lobbyists, they also lobby NBC, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News. All these groups have a AIPAC person assigned to them to promote what AIPAC wants us to hear. So this existential threat is that AIPAC's promoting, that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon because they use it against us. That's not a matter, that's not David Gray's opinion, that's not anyone's opinion, it's a matter of public record based upon AIPAC's own policy papers. AIPAC has for many years, decades, framed Iran's nuclear ambitions as a major security concern, consistently describing Iran as a potential threat to its public policy. In its public policy, they've been saying that in their congressional briefings. AIPAC has congressional briefings where they brief Congress people. They mention it there, been doing that for decades. It's just played a significant role in them arguing, in them lobbying, in their campaigns, and in their policy papers that we have to agree as Americans. This is their message, that Americans have to agree that we have to prevent Iran from developing nuclear capabilities. And its messages, they always highlight the worst case scenario. The thing that should most scare you is what's always in our policy papers, in our congressional briefings. These worst case scenarios involving just regional instability, nuclear escalation, which really reflect the organization's stated focus is on Israel's security. Now, we can't be mad at AIPAC. We can't be mad at AIPAC for saying that that they want to protect their interest. Right? I'm sure if Black Americans, if we had a lobby and we had a person assigned, a Black person assigned to every congressperson, every news outlet, I'm sure the interests of Black Americans would probably be better protected than they are. Aunt Jemima would probably still be on a food box. Right? But we lost Aunt Jemima, didn't we? We lost Uncle Ben. If Black people had a lobby, I'm sure that Uncle Ben would still be on rice. Right? But, you know, Black Americans don't. Right? I'm sure, Native Americans, they apparently have a lobby. Some of them. What happened to the Cleveland Indian logo, right? So you can't fault people for protecting their own interests. There are some people who wish they had what AIPAC has, a lot of power, okay? But at the same time, AIPAC's, their voice of influence in governments and in think tanks, it is overemphasized in such a way that it shapes, it distorts, and it contorts U.S. foreign policy to such a degree that it's incoherent and inconsistent. Because the foreign policy is so shaped on whatever the Jews want, whatever they want. Because the AIPAC and the Jews just know how to work this system better than anyone else. Let's just admit that. So much so that we've dropped bombs on two countries now because certain countries, such as Iran and Iraq, cannot have nuclear weapons. Because if they do, they'll kill the Jews. That's what contributes to shaping U.S. discourse on Iran and national security, AIPAC. So this fear-based myth that we can't let Iran get a nuclear weapon because they will use it against Israel comes directly from the Jews. Why? Now let's get to the most important question. Why? Now, before I answer that, I have something else I want to ask you. What if I told you that BlackRock is positioned to profit more from global conflict than any other asset manager in the world? Vanguard comes close, but BlackRock sits at the top as a fund manager that profits more from anyone else from conflict in the world. It's routinely the largest shareholder in nearly every major U.S. defense contractor, with its iShares index funds and holdings, and holding enormous stakes, sometimes up to 15% ownership stake, majority ownership stake in companies that profit from selling everything needed to kill people in war. They have stakes in Lockheed Martin, the Northrop Grumman Group, Raytheon, General Dynamics, Boeing, everyone who makes the bombs, planes, guns, grenades. BlackRock has a stake in drones. It's unmatched scale. It far exceeds Vanguard and State Street, which are the other two largest. It gives its total dollar exposure billions to the war industry complex. It goes beyond weapons manufacturing. BlackRock also invests heavily. And guess what? You know, after you destroy a country, you destroy all their bombs, you destroy all their buildings. You know what has to happen next, right? Someone has to come in and rebuild it. Guess who also invests heavily in post-conflict reconstruction, engineering, and global infrastructure firms? BlackRock. So they make billions of dollars from destroying the world. Then they make billions of dollars from rebuilding what they destroyed. So they're working both ends. They also have lobbyists. They also have contracts that no one can win but them. This allows them to benefit not only from the buildup to war, but also from the rebuilding that follows. This is crazy. So this dual exposure, defense production and reconstruction, makes BlackRock uniquely positioned to generate the broadest and most the deepest financial gains from prolonged geopolitical instability compared to any other major fund. Okay. So BlackRock profits from war immensely, whether it's in Iran or Ukraine, Africa, South America. It doesn't matter whether we went and took Panama, just the buildup to moving equipment there, getting equipment, buying more equipment, buying planes, just all this stuff. They profit from the buildup, from the destruction and the reconstruction. That's BlackRock. Now, what if I told you that the CEO of BlackRock is Larry Fink, a Jew? Again, this isn't David beating up on the Jews or being some sort of anti-Zionist, whatever that is. I'm just connecting some dots for you that you need to know before you go around believing the myth that we can't let Iran get a nuclear weapon because they'll use it against Israel. Because AIPAC told you that. You know, one thing the church is pointing to is, in this regard, is how much war has changed since World War I and World War II. And I talk about this. I'll drop this essay over that I wrote on stdominicsmedia.com. So it's this one. It's called St. Augustine's Just War Theory versus BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street. The corporate war industry. So in this essay, I go through it just explaining the difference between when the just war theory was invented, when there were actual issues, and it was actually self-defense. You had the Visigoths, the Huns, the Vandals, different Viking communities, you know, just coming down and just raping women and doing all types of stuff, right? Just war theory was a little bit different back then. Application was a lot different than some people from AIPAC and some people from BlackRock and State Street had meeting with the president and saying, oh, yeah, you know, we really need to take care of Iran, because if they get nuclear weapons, they're going to use them against Israel. So let us sell you some weapons, sell you some planes, sell you some bombs, you know, slide you, you know, make sure, you know, people like Nancy Pelosi and all you guys and all your other, you know, what's the one guy, Lindsey Graham, make sure you guys invest in BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street. You know, you can enrich yourselves. You know, with this whole thing as well, by the way. So war is the idea of just war is even not even applicable in a sense to what was going on when the theory was created. War nowadays is a boardroom decision, not a situation that happens because your life actually feels threatened. Now, people are making money off of this. War is a whole product. It's a product. Listen, war is a product that lobbyists sell. It's wholesale. War is a wholesale product that lobbyists sell to politicians. They buy it, and then the politicians then sell it to you guys at retail rates. And you buy it because you're scared. You're the consumer of war. You buy it because you're scared. And then because you're scared, you repeat these myths on Facebook and to your friends and to whoever will hear you. Iran must not get a nuclear weapon, because if they do it, they'll use it against Israel. You bought that for free. Oh, it was a price, actually. You're paying for it. But myths are free. And the only thing that happens when you do it is that when you buy that myth, and then you repeat it, all it does is causes suffering to the poor and making people like Nancy Pelosi and the Cheneys and the Bushes, all these people, wealthier. And, of course, the Jews over at BlackRock. And I didn't tell you all this to say that Iran is some sort of innocent country. No. Iran is a bad actor. They do fund terrorist groups with weapons that BlackRock makes money off of. And with those weapons, they harm, you know, people in Israel. And Israel's neighbors cause pain and suffering in the name of self-defense. You know, but Israel also is also a bad neighbor. They also commit genocide and suffering. Same with Russia and Ukraine. They're both evil countries. So Iran is a friend to Israel's enemies. And the United States is a friend to Israel. But what if I told you last year, Israel and the United States went on a campaign to destroy Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon? Then they turned their attention onto the country that funded those groups in Hamas and Hezbollah, Iran. But what if I told you also that the United Nations rights experts have found and discovered that BlackRock profited from its investments in weapons, manufacturing, supplies, supplying Israel during the Gaza conflict? They noted that the firm's major stakes in Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, and RTX companies provided things such as F-35 fighter jets, precision-guided missiles, artillery shells, armored vehicles, drones, surveillance platforms, and air defense components used throughout the fighting. These defense contractors saw billions in revenue as demand surged from 23 to 25. We're just talking about the Israel, Hezbollah, and Hamas conflict. I'm not even going to give you Ukraine and Russia. You should already know what's going on here. Billions from just 23 to 25 in this conflict, just regional escalations, with United Nations reports and investigative journalism describing the period as highly profitable for arms makers and their investors, because BlackRock has roughly $36 billion invested in military weapons companies, and even modest increases in the value of those firms translated into substantial gains across its portfolios, giving it one of the largest exposures and financial benefits of any global asset manager during conflict. That's just Israel, Lebanon, and Gaza. So to answer the question that I initially asked, why were you sold that myth that Iran would use a nuclear weapon against Israel if they got one? Why didn't you think about that? Because logically, the crap doesn't even make sense. Why would Iran use a nuclear weapon on a country that has its holy sites as Muslims? If their friends are in Gaza and Lebanon, and a nuclear weapon would affect them as well, this close proximity, why would they use it? It would even affect them. They're so close. It doesn't make any sense, but you bought it. You bought that myth. It wasn't even logical for you to buy it. It's like buying a car without an engine. It made no sense. But you were told that story by the Jews and their allies to make you afraid, so that they could play you like a flute, so that they can accumulate power and wealth off of you. Now, the next question is, why did you believe it? Well, you believed it because you didn't think. You reacted emotionally. And that was their goal. This has been David L. Gray, The Morning. Let's get to your comments and I'll get out of here. Yeah, okay, I see you guys beat this up pretty good. All right, let me see what you got for me. Let me see what you got in the comments. Laura Anderson. Yeah, Laura likes to point this out, and it's a fact. You know, we don't really think about everyone's in on child sacrifice. Everyone's in. I was talking to someone yesterday, like, oh, I'm Republican, and like, I'm like, is there really still two parties? Is there? I mean, they're both for child sacrifice. I mean, Republicans are all in on IVF. They're also all in for the abortion pill. They both flying gay flags. They're both for war. I don't know the difference, but we don't talk about IVF anymore, do we? Just, It's crazy. John says, Islam has been attacking America all my life. John CL says, I don't trust the USCCB or the Vatican. I mean, you don't have to trust. I mean, I hope you don't trust me. I mean, I think we just have to trust what is true. If it's true, it's true. Like, I don't trust people either. I mean, I just trust the truth. Marmara says, I'm hearing too that Iran's Islamic religion is killing in an oppressive nation. They are. They're bad. I mean, they did have a color revolution. Remember, Michael Jones was on talking about that. I mean, they did have a color revolution. They had some protests that probably is CIA funded and Iran suppressed like you haven't seen since Rwanda. It was. I think we probably need to stop funding. You know, it's one thing for, you know, for interest groups in the United States to go fund Black Lives Matter and destroy our cities and burn up some stuff. And you never notice in all the cities where they were tearing up and destroying, they never destroyed one Planned Parenthood, even though it was in those same neighborhoods, right? But I think we just have to stop funding terrorism domestically. And, you know, we get mad at Israel funding terrorists, but you know, we fund our own source of terrorism and revolutions as well. It's people, we just aren't good people, and our foreign policy is trash. Like, everyone's foreign policy. No one desires the best for the other country. You know, it's America first, it's Germany first. No one really cares. And then when you do care, try to care, you know, you can't care because people call you a globalist. They'll say you don't care, but I really think there's a way to love everyone. I think there is. I just don't think we've ever seen it in public policy and in constitutional governments or perhaps in monarchies. I don't think we've ever seen it. But, well, I think we have to believe it's possible, right? I don't know. Man, John is up in here bitter. John, why'd you eat a bitter bar? Don't eat bitter bars. They're not good for you. John is saying, American and Catholic Church has been lying to me all my life. If it wasn't for the sacraments, I've left the church decades ago. I don't know if the church has lied to you. I think human beings have lied to you. That maybe are in the church. Like, I don't know how the church can lie to you. I don't know even how that's theologically possible. And I don't think you can even recite the creed if you actually believe that. Like, I believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church. Like, how can you recite the creed if you believe that same church lied to you? I don't know. I think you're eating a bitter bar, my friend. Marmar says, is the global elite stowing out all the fear? No. I mean, if we're going to call global elites like the 2%, I think I see what you're saying in that regard. Maybe people in the church have lied to us, but a church, a divine institution. Oh yeah, Matthew already said what I said. Thanks. Appreciate you. Iranian memes on Trump are getting hilarious. Yeah, that's you know, I'm watching Daredevil now. This is what, season 3 or 4? It's on Disney now. And Mayor Fink, who is the kingpin, there's somebody going around making these crazy memes of him. And so his reaction is to find a person who's making me. So he's so upset about the memes. So upset. He's not laughing about them at all, even though they're funny. And now his thing is like, oh, I got to find a person making the memes and kill them. imagine if Trump was like Kingpin, like, because these memes are wild. These memes are crazy. Hey, Brianna. I guess you're still in Disney. Yeah, this is just the off show. I just came in to say one thing. I'm about to get out of here. It's Thursday. I'll be back Friday. So I wanted to come in and jump on something I couldn't jump on otherwise. Marmar says, average Joe American doesn't even know where Iran is on a map unless it's teacher. Isn't that the truth? All right, let's get out of here. I'll catch you guys on tomorrow. Like I said, we'll be back tomorrow. We got William Priest in here. He'll be hearing about his conversion story from Protestantism to rad trad to normie Catholic, sacrament loving, Jesus loving person. But until then, until next time, blessings and peace to you and yours. This has been David L. Gray in the morning.
Hey yo, wake up. New day, new mercy, fresh light on the way. Coffee in the cup, let the silence pray. Word for your walk, truth for your mind. We read the signs, but we don't lose time. Culture talk, scripture sharp. Faith with rhythm, intellect with heart. No panic, no noise, just wisdom and grace. Morning hits different when you start in this place. Wake up, yeah. Tap in right now, let the truth hit soft. Let it hit profound. Wake up, don't scroll past prayer. It's David L. Gray in the morning. Meet me there. Breathe deep, set your pace. Faith ain't heavy when it's put in place. Start with God, then face the day. That's the kind of morning that don't fade away. Like it, yeah, let it play. Share it, yeah, pass it on your way. Sub up, don't hesitate. David L. Gray in the morning, don't be late. Mm-hmm.